gadgets we have invented make sure we stay busy and never notice what is right in front of us. That's life in the 21st century. Wouldn't it be better to take back the reins from the many distractions we've created? From gods to things. In the past, people lived in a world inhabited by invisible beings and gods. These days, we've replaced them with things that can be measured, weighed, and counted. We want to create things, and we want to own, build, and invest. Yet our hopes and fears haven't diminished. In fact, they're stronger than ever. We worry more, and worries are suffering. Among all the different types of suffering, the worst is the pain we feel in our minds. If we're not careful, and we don't begin to see things for what they are, we risk becoming less caring, loving, and trusting. The more importance we place on our possessions, the more our relationships with others will suffer. We trust technology and money more than we trust those around us. We obsess about our career and forget our family. Enemy of happiness. All our troubles come from the urge to take possession of things. That urge is the archenemy of happiness, an unwholesome impulse that causes conflict and disharmony. Desire and selfishness are mental weapons of mass destruction, and they are tearing our world apart, literally and figuratively. The Buddha warned us against them, but he also explained the origins of desire and selfishness and showed us how to break free of their grip. Now it's up to us to learn about the tools that are at our disposal. Self-deception. Often when I hear people talking about receiving the introduction to the nature of mind, they make it sound like something unbelievably amazing, something magical. There is a tendency to believe that if only we can be introduced to the nature of mind, we won't need anything else at all. And in a way, of course, it's true. When an authentic master introduces a qualified student to the nature of mind, nothing else is needed. Sometimes the mere meeting of master and disciple is enough for the student not only to recognize the nature of mind, but also to gain stability in that recognition, even if the student has no prior knowledge of the Dharma. But such cases are more rare than stars in the midday sky. That doesn't mean it's impossible for people like us to recognize the nature of mind, because that's definitely possible. But a bit of honest self-appraisal would serve us well. We may seek out one master after another so that we can listen to some poetic, well-chosen words about the nature of mind. And it may also be that those words somehow strike a chord in us. But does that mean that we have actually experienced and recognized the nature of mind? Or was it simply an idea, a thought, or a mood that came over us? Things must be absolutely clear to both the master and student. Otherwise, we're just fooling ourselves, and that won't get us anywhere. Let go. The introduction to impermanence is important, but it's just as important that we learn how to handle that knowledge, because there is hardly a more painful recognition. So now it's time for the next instruction. What do we do once we have recognized that nothing lasts? Here is a simple and effective technique. Let go. Don't hold on so tightly. The more you let go, the less it hurts. Let go entirely, and the pain is gone. On the other hand, the more we grasp, the more painful it is. That's a very clear, simple, and effective instruction. It's easy to understand, and we get the point. So now that we have gained that realization, it's up to us to make use of that insight. In any case, from this day on, we no longer need to wonder how to handle the pain when something ends, changes, ages, or disappears. Letting go is immediately applicable and more precious than gold. That is the first step. A good heart. Next comes the introduction to love and compassion. We all need love and compassion. Without these two, we cannot even take care of ourselves. And if we're unable to take care of ourselves, then how could we ever manage to look after others? Love and compassion aren't just religious virtues. Everyone agrees that having a good heart is important. So having that view does not require believing in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, nor is it necessary to believe in cause and effect, or in reincarnation for that matter. It's a natural belief that we all share. Two kinds of love. What makes a heart good? We like to talk about love, but often such talk is just fancy words. Behind the facade, our love mostly is anything but unconditional. Ordinary romantic love is actually quite egoistic. I love you because you love me. The Buddha talked about great love and compassion. What is meant by great? At night, when everything is dark, even a tiny light shines brightly. Ordinary love is like a tiny light in the dark of night. But when the sun rises at dawn, it shines its light on every one of us. Great love is like the brilliant sun. No light shines brighter than that. Even if we lit every candle and turned on every electric light in this world, it would all pale in comparison to the brilliant light of the sun. Great love burns with an incredible strength and intensity. It heals and purifies. All obscurations and destructive emotions disappear. Self-importance, greed, pride, doubt, and envy vanish, and all that is good appears. What is meant by all that is good? Goodness is honesty. Goodness is warmth and care. Goodness is insight and wisdom. When the mind is filled with love, true, unconditional love, it is naturally honest and pure. It happens automatically, no matter who we are or what we believe in. Who's on the right path? Having a pure, loving mind doesn't require being a religious person. I've met people who don't believe in any religion, who don't follow any religious practice, and yet they are 100% honest and genuine. Such people are definitely on the right path. Their journey is pure and good. We might ask ourselves, why are they so honest and sincere? And the answer is that their minds are pure. Their minds are pure because they are caring and loving. They do not want to hurt, harm, or cheat anyone. So their journey is good. They're on the right path. This is simple cause and effect. On the other hand, it's also possible to be very religious, pious, and self-sacrificing, but at the same time suffer from intense pride. When we suffer from pride, we feel that we are better and more worthy than others. When others succeed, we feel annoyed and envious. When we are not applauded and praised, we feel offended. We feel that if others don't recognize us and thank us for what we have done, then why should we even bother? Despite our piety and good deeds, we might remain very ordinary on the inside. That is why it's important to know what it really means to be on the right path. One path. We need to maintain our practice at every moment, regardless of the circumstances. Our inspiration is impermanence, and our means are love and compassion. Only through loving kindness and insight into reality will we ever find true and lasting joy and the capacity to benefit both others and ourselves. Happiness and the cause of happiness can arise only through loving kindness and insight into the nature of things. There is no other way. Unless we understand this crucial point, there will be no end to our suffering. It doesn't matter how much we own or whether others respect us. It doesn't matter how influential we are or how lavishly we live. Life is always characterized by suffering. That's an innate flaw. We are unable to relax in the present moment, and we cannot appreciate things the way they are. Our anger, desire, and confusion stand between us and happiness. Two kinds of happiness. We all want happiness. Of course, people have their own particular ideas about what it means to be happy, but we all share the same basic wish to be happy. Now, roughly speaking, there are two types of happiness, conditioned and unconditioned. Unconditioned happiness refers to loving kindness and insight. It is a state of spontaneous love and wisdom that realizes the great emptiness that is the true nature of all things. All other possible states of mind are inevitably spoiled by destructive emotions, and wherever there are negative emotions, there will always be dissatisfaction and the feeling that things aren't the way they should be. Wealth, friends, fame, nothing helps. Why is it so hard to be happy and carefree? Why can't we just appreciate what we have? It is our anger, desire, and ignorance that mess it all up. An immediate effect. If we wish to be happy and of help to all others, then there's only one way forward. Loving kindness and insight into the emptiness that is the nature of things. Now, if we do take that path, will we be happy right away? And can we immediately guide others to happiness too? No, we cannot. But something does happen as soon as we embark on the path, because whenever we are loving, compassionate, and aware of emptiness, we simply cannot hurt anyone, either directly or indirectly. But that's not all. Everything we do will automatically be helpful to others, both directly and indirectly. It's actually quite simple. Helping others means giving them what they need. That may be something concrete, such as money or food, or maybe something less tangible, like safety and protection. Most valuable, however, is to pass on the insight that the Dharma has given us. Sadness, love, and insight. The Dharma is very clear about the causes of happiness and suffering. It also explains how to go beyond suffering, how to reach genuine and lasting happiness, and how to share that attainment with others. With a loving motivation and understanding of the way things are, we can explain to others the impermanence of all things. That's real sharing, because in that way we help others to see through their illusions. The profound disillusionment that inevitably follows the recognition of impermanence is both natural and necessary. We shouldn't shy away from it, because love is born from that sorrow, and love yields insight into the way things really are. These qualities and abilities are the source of perfect joy and happiness, for us and for all others. These are the qualities we should try to share and pass on. The love of a bodhisattva. In his classic account of the path of awakening, the Indian master Shantideva likens the love we feel for another person to the great love of a bodhisattva, a being on a path of compassionate awakening. When we love somebody, there's nothing we won't do to see that person happy. We're always ready to help, protect, and comfort. That's how love is. Love makes us patient. Love makes us persevere and endure. We all know what it's like to love another person, and we can use this knowledge to understand what it means to be a bodhisattva. The big difference between the love we feel for another person and the love that a bodhisattva feels is that the bodhisattva's love isn't limited to certain individuals or to a select group of people. Instead, the bodhisattva harbors a deep felt love for all beings, and at the same time always endeavors to become wiser, warmer, and even more loving. The path of the bodhisattva is a journey toward wisdom and realization that is motivated by the wish to help others. 6 aspects of bodhisattva training. What happens when we begin to think and act like bodhisattvas? What happens when our constant inspiration is the wish that all beings may enjoy happiness and the causes of happiness while remaining free from suffering and the causes of suffering? At that point, we begin to cultivate 6 extraordinary qualities: generosity, discipline, patience, enthusiasm, concentration, and insight. These are commonly referred to as the 6 perfections. 1. Generosity. Generosity is the practice of giving. It's the training in being generous with things, food, money, protection, and care. Generosity is born from love. We are already generous towards the ones we love, so generosity is a natural expression of love. But unlike ordinary people, a bodhisattva is generous toward everybody. And among all things we could possibly offer to others, the Dharma is the most precious. 2. Discipline. Discipline is the next quality, but what is discipline for a bodhisattva? It means living in accord with the wish not to harm anyone and to do all that one can to be of benefit. That kind of discipline also springs from love. All excellent qualities blossom when a bodhisattva maintains this discipline in thought, word, and deed. 3. Patience. Love is patient, and the love of a bodhisattva endures all hardships, disappointments, pain, and hurt. Patience is the ability to accept adversity, not be discouraged. Patience opens our minds to the Dharma. 4. Enthusiasm. Enthusiasm is the joy of doing good deeds. A bodhisattva is deeply engaged in developing the qualities that are essential to the spiritual path. The wish to be free, loving kindness, and insight. That process is fueled by great joy. 5. Concentration. Concentration refers to training the mind through meditation. Bodhisattvas have a balanced and composed mind. When the mind is calm and at ease, it also becomes agile and capable of wonderful achievements. 6. Insight. Insight arises from training in the first 5 qualities: generosity, discipline, patience, enthusiasm, and concentration. Insight is twofold: awareness of things as they appear and awareness of things as they really are. Insight dawns when the mind has achieved composure and agility by means of practice. 4 means of attraction. In their interactions with others, bodhisattvas also apply what are known as the 4 means of attraction. The first is to provide others with the things they wish for. The second is to speak in a way that is pleasant and delightful to listen to. The third is to teach in a way that is adjusted to the capacities and contexts of the audience. Finally, the fourth is to practice what one teaches. With those 4 means of attraction, others will naturally gather around us in a setting where the Dharma can flourish. A gradual path. The Bodhisattva path is a gradual path. It begins with a wish to help others. When that wish is genuine, it will naturally affect the way we act. We need to be careful, however, not to overestimate ourselves and attempt to do things that we aren't ready for. It's important to allow the process to unfold naturally and for our hearts to be in it all the way. If we bite off more than we can chew, nobody benefits. Take the Buddhist ideal of infinite generosity, for instance. Here, one is ready to give away even one's own body. That kind of generosity is not something that should be forced. Instead, our generosity must be natural and relaxed. As we begin to hold on to things less tightly, and as we train in sharing with others, we will gradually become more adept at giving and more able to see clearly the benefits of generosity. Quietly but steadily, we become capable of increasingly greater deeds. This is true for all 6 aspects of the Bodhisattva training. Our practice is not meant to break our backs or wear us down. It should be steady and natural. Sprouting seeds. The recognition of impermanence is the foundation for Buddhist practice. Spending time reflecting on the way everything conditioned is also impermanent is like plowing the fertile fields of our minds so the seeds that are naturally present in the soil can sprout. Love and compassion are like the rain and moisture that nourishes the seeds. And when the fields of our mind have been plowed with the realization of impermanence and watered with love and compassion, sprouts of insight grow. Over time, the sprouts evolve into 3 qualities: an acute awareness of impermanence, all-embracing love and compassion, and clear insight into the true nature of all things. Dashed illusions. We need to become aware of impermanence. The realization that everything disappears and that everything is unreliable is a devastating disappointment. As our dreams are shattered, we develop a nauseated sense of having had enough. And that revulsion in turn strengthens and nourishes our resolve to break free. Without that weariness, we lose focus. We become lazy and put off our training. Therefore, it's crucial that we realize the fundamental futility of our own existence. No longer having to shoulder our illusions, we instead develop the ability to let go and set ourselves free. That happens because we understand that the world and all its inhabitants are doomed to disappear, and that no matter what we may achieve, it won't last. The same goes for our emotions, our thoughts, and our ideas. Everything is temporary. Everything is transient and impermanent. That realization comes with a deep sense of weariness that enables us to finally let go. What is there to covet and pursue? Suddenly we see the bigger picture and let go. There are many instructions and much that we can be introduced to, but if we wish to come face to face with the way things really are, there's no way around acknowledging impermanence. From Love to Wisdom. The next step in our introduction to the way things really are is the recognition that negative emotions are the root of all negative actions and pain. Our own anger, desire, and ignorance create all our pain and misery. Conversely, love and compassion are the root of all that is good. With love and compassion, our actions are automatically wholesome, and we feel good in both body and mind. When our minds are loving and compassionate, our negative emotions lose their footing, and when our destructive emotions fall away, our inherent wisdom has room to manifest. When we are told of this truth and personally acknowledge it, we have received a genuine introduction to the way things are. Bodhisattva Motivation. Once we recognize impermanence and begin to view beings with love and compassion, the time has come to begin our bodhisattva training. As we have seen, bodhisattva training teaches us to be generous and develop discipline, to be patient and enthusiastic, and to train our consciousness so that it becomes more grounded and flexible. The goal is to reach insight into the way things really are, while at the same time staying focused on the happiness and well-being of all others without exception. That is how we should train once we have understood that love and compassion are the root of all good, and that destructive emotions are the root of all negativity. No matter our circumstances and no matter who might be in front of us, we are determined to do what is right, constructive, and most helpful to others. In short, we adapt our training to the situation at hand. At the same time, we must take care not to develop any expectation of reward. Otherwise, it's easy to end up thinking that we are special and that all the good deeds we do for others somehow ought to elicit a reward. But bodhisattvas are special precisely because they don't expect a reward or gratitude. In fact, bodhisattvas don't even consider their training to be a means for generating merit. A bodhisattva's only motivation is the loving and compassionate attitude I just mentioned. Pain and suffering are caused by anger, desire, and ignorance, while all good things are due to love and compassion. As soon as we receive that instruction and take it to heart, we need to act on it. The way bodhisattvas act on that understanding is by training in the six perfections and the four means of attracting others. Warning signs. Bodhisattva training is characterized by a total absence of competitiveness, envy, and conceit. So if we find ourselves becoming envious or annoyed at those who are more generous, disciplined, or intelligent than we are, we can be certain that something is very wrong. It means that we have misunderstood something fundamental about our practice. Likewise, if we feel compelled to outdo our peers, or if we despise and feel superior to those beneath us, something has definitely gone wrong. In all such cases, we have missed the point of our practice. The teachings depend on the listener. People are different, and so the Buddha gave a great number of different teachings. Various topics are emphasized depending on the audience. Some people don't need to receive lengthy, detailed explanations in order to master their practice. They are naturally ready. For others, it's a bit more complicated, and still others require a lot of instruction. Because we are all different, the Buddha gave us different things to work with, different instructions that fit our individual capacities. Eliminating desire. Some people listen to the teachings of the Buddha and conclude that since desire is the cause of destructive emotions and negative thought patterns, the main point is to eliminate personal wants and needs. Such people consider desire to be the biggest hindrance on the spiritual path, and so their practice focuses on eradicating desire. They choose a simple lifestyle and do not keep anything beyond the bare necessities. Based on such a modest and unassuming lifestyle, they train their minds to eliminate craving and fascination with impermanent phenomena. Instead, they commit themselves to cultivating insight into the true nature of things. Thereby, they accomplish the realization that there is no individual self or ego, and that is a liberating insight. That is one way to break free from conditioned existence. The Bodhisattva Path. Another set of instructions contains an insight that is sharper, involving practices that are more profound and transformative. This is known as the Great Vehicle, or the Bodhisattva Path. Here, the goal is to realize the emptiness that is the true nature of all things, and employ this realization for the benefit of all beings. Bodhisattvas train in arousing the mind of awakening. As they gradually master their training, they undergo a transformation, traditionally divided in 5 phases known as the 5 paths, and 10 stages called the 10 grounds. This process culminates in their attainment of the fully awakened state. In this way, bodhisattvas traverse the complete path to Buddhahood. While others focus on overcoming desire, practitioners of the bodhisattva path primarily seek to overcome aggression and transform all destructive emotions into their positive counterparts. The Vajra Vehicle. These days, the teachings aimed at eliminating desire are practiced in countries such as Sri Lanka, Thailand, and Myanmar. In these countries, men and women become monks and nuns in order to train in contentment with only the most basic possessions while committed to the practice of meditation and insight. The various traditions that emphasize the bodhisattva path of compassionate engagement are to be found in countries such as Japan, Korea, and China. But there is also a third path known as the Vajra Vehicle, or the Tantric Path, which has been practiced especially in Tibet. Thanks to the masters of the past, we still have access to the unique instructions and methods of the Vajra Vehicle. Those methods and instructions have brought great results, both in India, where the tradition originated, and later in Tibet, where people kept the instructions alive and passed them on for the benefit of future generations. These instructions make the awakened state reachable quickly and with very little hardship. The 4 Outer Preliminary Practices. In the past, the masters of the Vajra Vehicle often began their training by reflecting on 4 topics that are expressed in 4 statements. We should also give careful and sincere thought to these 4 because they have the power to transform the way we think and the way we look at life. 1. Your current body is a precious tool. 2. Nothing lasts. Everything changes and comes to an end. 3. All actions have consequences. 4. Life, death, and rebirth are characterized by suffering. If we take these 4 statements to heart, we become fit for the practices that follow. That is why reflecting on these 4 points are known as the 4 outer preliminary practices. However, in the Vajra Vehicle, it is crucial to also train in seeing everything as pure and perfect. Such pure perception is the foundation for all our practice in this vehicle, so we must always maintain the profound perspective of purity, even as we reflect on the 4 statements contained in the outer preliminaries. Right view. Before we move to the inner preliminary practices, it would be appropriate to say a few words about insight. It is said that the insight one gains from the Buddha's teachings is insight into the way things really are. That insight we can also call right view. As we have already mentioned, right view is related to the understanding of dependent origination. When someone fully understands dependent origination, that person automatically adopts right view. It is said that phenomena are empty of any nature of their own because they arise in dependence on causes and conditions. Whenever we understand the meaning of that statement, not just intellectually, but in our actual experience, we have arrived at right view. Dependent origination is described as a chain of 12 links, the first of which is ignorance. With right view, we see how ignorance is the basis for the negative conditioning of our minds and how it perpetuates the karmic actions that keep us tied in a vicious circle of cause and effect. Right view is the knowledge that cuts through and dissolves our fundamental ignorance. This knowledge leads to complete freedom from the painful cycle of birth, death, and rebirth, also known as samsara. The four inner preliminary practices. Contemplating the four outer preliminaries makes our minds stronger and more flexible. Our minds become like a fertile field cleared of rocks and weeds. The seeds we sow in such a field will sprout and turn into healthy crops. Once we have come that far, it's time to begin the four inner preliminary practices. 1. Refuge and the mind of awakening. The first of the four inner preliminary practices involves taking refuge and arousing the mind of awakening. Taking refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, and giving rise to the mind of awakening, are combined with physical prostrations. The result is both a mental and physical exercise that purifies us of all the negativity we have caused throughout the unwholesome use of our body, in this life as well as in all previous existences. The negativity is purified as we use our body to express our respect and devotion while mentally taking refuge in the three jewels and developing the mind of awakening. Refuge is the root of liberation. The mind of awakening is the root of omniscience. Their combination is the first of the four inner preliminary practices. 2. Meditation on Buddha Vajrasattva. The next spiritual exercise is the meditation on the Buddha Vajrasattva. This practice also purifies, but this time the focus is particularly on all the negative things we have said. Here we aim to purify the negative effects of all the hurtful words we have ever spoken and all that we have said that has caused discord or misfortune in this life as well as in all our past existences. All such misuse of our voice has had a negative impact on the way we are, and we continue to carry this negativity with us. Although caused by our voice, such unwholesome factors also manifest in our body and mind. To become free of that kind of negativity, we train in confessing our past negative actions, visualizing Vajrasattva, and perceiving the healing and purifying stream of nectar that flows from him as we recite his mantra. 3. Making offerings. For practitioners of the Vajra vehicle, the way to arrive at the right view is by engaging in the third of the inner preliminary practices, the offering. This is a symbolic offering that involves outer, inner, and innermost levels of meaning. On the outer level, we offer all that is good, beautiful, and wholesome in the world. On the inner level, we offer our body and fortune. By making such outer and inner offerings, we are able to realize the way things truly are beyond all concepts. That non-conceptual understanding is itself the innermost offering, and this is indeed the greatest offering possible. The real reason we make offerings is to free ourselves from those misconceptions and wrong views that prevent the right view from dawning within us. As we make offerings to Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, we purify the negativity that is built up from thinking and perceiving in a self-centered way that is out of touch with reality. In this way, by making offerings on three levels to the awakened Buddhas, we purify our minds of all such negativity. That's how mental obscurations are removed, according to the Vajra vehicle. 4. Merging with the Guru. The last of the inner preliminaries is the practice of merging our minds with the wisdom mind of the Guru. This practice, which is at the core of all training in the Vajra vehicle, ensures great results swiftly and easily. In this meditation, we receive the blessings of our main Guru and all the other masters in the wisdom lineage. In this way, we connect with the awakened wisdom of the lineage. That is why this is such a powerful practice. By merging our minds with the Guru, we become able to realize in our own experience, suddenly and directly, the purity of all phenomena, the crucial insight that lies at the heart of the teachings of the Vajra vehicle. In this practice, we first pray to our main Guru, as well as all lineage masters and all other awakened beings. We recall the precious qualities that these beings demonstrate with their body, speech, and mind, and we rejoice in those qualities. In particular, we rejoice in the power of their instructions, those instructions that enable us to care and provide for all beings, if only we take them to heart. We then supplicate these masters to bless us so that we may realize the nature of mind and lead all beings to liberation and awakening. Finally, we train by receiving empowerment from our main Guru and merging our own mind with his or her wisdom mind, inseparably as one. Pure perception. The Vajra vehicle has many methods, but they all hinge on whether we are able to perceive things as pure and perfect. If we have that ability, we can definitely gain a lot from practicing the Vajra vehicle. But not many people are that fortunate. Our normal, ignorant consciousness is constantly engaged in unwholesome thinking, and we are always ready to act on our feelings of aversion, attachment, and ignorance. If we cannot relate to the instructions our master and our fellow practitioners with an understanding that everything is pure and perfect, then things can go very wrong. So it's important to stay clear of doubt and wrong views. This, of course, is how we must relate to the teachings, our teacher, and our fellow practitioners. But it also applies to all other beings. Only then will our practice become flawless and pure. Ultimately, that is why we train in merging our minds with the wisdom mind of the Guru. Signs of progress. The preliminary practices are both beneficial and practical. We should train in them with an open and sincere mind. We should not rush through the practices, but we must also not drag them out indefinitely. When we begin these practices, we will notice that our minds begin to change. The way we react is different from before. Clarity, warmth, and strength blossom from within. We are more balanced and flexible, and our impulses and emotions have less of a grip on us. Gradually, we become more caring, devoted, and intelligent. Those are the surest signs that the preliminary practices are working as intended. There are also other signs that our training is effective, but those are secondary. Such signs can appear in dreams, for example. Empowerment. When we have completed both the inner and outer preliminary practices, we have truly stepped onto the path of the Vajra vehicle. Then it becomes time to receive the ripening empowerments and the liberating instructions. That is how wisdom is transmitted in the Vajra vehicle. We say that the mind is matured through empowerment and liberated through instruction. The ripening empowerments introduce us to the way things really are. As we have talked about before, the words introduction and pointing out should be understood in that way, bringing us face to face with the way things really are. In the Vajra vehicle, such an introduction typically takes place through a ritual of 4 empowerments conferred by a qualified master to a student. Each empowerment introduces a particular insight. These 4 insights can be described as follows. All sights are visible emptiness. All sounds are audible emptiness. All sensations are blissful emptiness. All concepts are thought-free wakefulness. The first two, showing that whatever we see and hear is indivisible from emptiness, are also explained in the philosophy of the Great Vehicle. The difference is that the Great Vehicle conveys these points through philosophical reflection, whereas in the Vajra Vehicle, these insights are actually experienced, transmitted by means of a ritual. The third empowerment reveals that all sensations are blissful emptiness. Here, the subtle channels, energies, and essences within the body are used to facilitate the realization that all sensations, whether pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, are in fact nothing but great bliss. Unlike the first two empowerments, this process is unique to the Vajra Vehicle. So is the fourth empowerment, the revelation that the true nature of thoughts is primordial, thought-free wakefulness. The essence of thought is thought-free wakefulness. When this is pointed out to us, we can directly recognize that the nature of thoughts is wisdom. In the Vajra Vehicle, there are many practices and approaches, but the perspective of the fourth and final empowerment is the culmination of them all. Here, we are brought face to face with the true nature of thoughts. We experience the nature of thoughts as thought-free wakefulness. It is crucial, however, for our experience to be authentic. Otherwise, it cannot lead to authentic realization. If we intellectualize the fourth empowerment and misunderstand its significance, then the path is closed off. If we believe that we have had an experience of the way things are, and yet that is not the case, then the path is blocked, because everything we do subsequently will unfold based on a false premise. Misunderstanding emptiness. We need to be clear about the right view. The view is the basis for our training. It is our understanding of the view that determines whether our practice is authentic. If we develop wrong view, there will be errors across the board. Indeed, the nature of misunderstanding is to incorrectly think that one has understood. For instance, in the context of Buddhist philosophy, this might occur if we feel that our understanding of emptiness is perfect, even though we only have an intellectual understanding of emptiness, which is a far cry from the profundity of actual experiential insight. If that misunderstanding is left unchecked, our practice can degenerate into a habit of just ruminating on a set of choice concepts, and so we get stuck spiritually. To gain a real understanding of emptiness, we must receive instructions directly from a realized master who has an actual experience of emptiness, him or herself. Misunderstanding the nature of mind. Just as we can be wrong about emptiness, we can also be mistaken about the nature of mind. For example, we might think we know how to sustain the recognition of the nature of mind, while in fact we don't. Perhaps we think that it's just a matter of being mindful of our thoughts as they come and go. All we do then is sit and watch our thoughts. We try to monitor every little impulse and perception. Unfortunately, that has nothing whatsoever to do with recognizing the nature of mind. Misunderstanding wakefulness. The same goes for mind's original wakefulness. Realizing primordial wakefulness is a matter of recognizing thought-free wakefulness. When we hear that, we might get the impression that we just have to make sure not to have any thoughts. But just having no thoughts is surely not the same as actualizing thought-free wakefulness. Thought-free wakefulness is bright, sharp, vivid, and direct. It has to unfold like that if we want the recognition of thought-free wakefulness to be our practice. In other words, it is crucial that we see things as they are. Otherwise, our misunderstanding can quickly take us down a dead end. The Supreme Guide. The preliminary practices save us from dead ends. That is also the reason we seek guidance in Buddhist teachings. That is why the words of the Buddha have been passed on from generation to generation, and why we study the classical commentaries and treatises to this day. The oral instructions serve the same purpose, but it's crucial to receive them from someone who already embodies the insight and experience that the instructions are meant to transmit. In other words, our teacher has to be someone who has realized the true nature of reality, someone we can trust because he or she speaks from experience. That kind of a teacher can faultlessly communicate the instructions to us and ensure that we don't misunderstand them. That is why it's so important to meet a qualified guide and keep contact with him or her until it's all perfectly clear to us. A special path. All Buddhist traditions focus on arriving at the right view. Still, these days it seems that many people are particularly interested in the instructions of the Vajra vehicle. That's undoubtedly because the Vajra vehicle doesn't require us to give up things we enjoy in life. Indeed, in the Vajra vehicle, such things are considered the very path of awakening. The five destructive emotions, delusion, desire, anger, pride, and envy, are seen as the path to awakening in a single lifetime, and samsara is recognized as the awakened state itself. A calm mind. If we want the five destructive emotions to be our path to awakening in a single lifetime, then we need the right view, and our practice must be in accord with the fundamental purity of all things. Everything stands and falls with the introduction to the nature of mind, and our recognition of the right view. To achieve the right view, there are a number of things we can do. For instance, one special technique prepares us for the right view by allowing our minds to relax and quiet down. It is easier to recognize the right view when the mind is calm. At the same time, we must understand that this technique is merely a means and not an end in itself. Calm mind is not the same as liberation. But unless our minds are calm, our ability to realize the way things are cannot develop. That's why it is sometimes said that insight requires a calm mind. If you take a glass of murky water and keep stirring it, the water will never become clear. But if you stop stirring, the impurities will slowly sink to the bottom until finally the water is perfectly clear. Our mind is the same way. When we stop feeding our thoughts and let the mind settle, it clears up all by itself. Uncontrived naturalness. There are many kinds of mental calm, but in the Vajra vehicle we find a kind that is particularly useful. It's called uncontrived naturalness. That type of meditation is very simple. All we need to do is let the mind be exactly as it is. Produce nothing. Suppress nothing. Just let your mind be exactly as it is right now, in this very moment, completely free from hopes or expectations. It sounds easy and straightforward, and it is easy. However, because the habit of doing and acting is so ingrained in our being, it can actually be very difficult not to do anything at all. So we need to be aware and continuously remind ourselves that there isn't anything to do. When we remember to simply let the mind be just as it is, then the mind assumes a natural poise. That kind of mental calm is the best possible calmness. From there, true insight can begin to unfold. Technique versus realization. When the mind is at rest, there is space for true wisdom to unfold. It is therefore crucial for us to know how to calm the mind. To achieve a calm mind, there's no better method than simply resting naturally in the present moment. But remember, this is just a method, not a goal in itself. Letting the mind rest in uncontrived naturalness is not the same as having recognized the nature of mind. It is the gateway to realization, wisdom, and insight, but not identical with realization. It is so important to understand that difference. Resting the mind in uncontrived naturalness is a technique that facilitates the birth of wisdom. When mind is allowed to rest naturally just as it is, then recognizing the nature of mind is not difficult at all. Many methods, one purpose. There are many things we can do to rest in uncontrived naturalness and recognize the nature of mind. Many practices help clear the obscurations in our minds and bring the right conditions together. All the many techniques, practices, studies, reflections, contemplations, and meditations share a single goal, facilitating our recognition of the nature of mind. That's also why we pray to the awakened masters and ask them for blessings and help. This is why we train in mingling our minds indivisibly with their awakened mind. That training has one purpose, to enable our recognition of the nature of mind. Solitude. If you wish to realize the nature of mind, it is helpful to spend time in a peaceful, quiet place where there are no distractions. Find a remote place, far from worldly affairs, where you can focus on the Dharma. That is the best place to be. There you can put aside the worries and concerns of everyday life and instead spend time on what truly matters. Masters of the past did this, and so should we. As beginners, we will find progress close to impossible unless we set aside special periods for our practice. We need to spend time in retreat. That's how our practice can pick up speed and gain impetus. Tibetan tradition recommends that we set aside 3 years for practice in retreat. If that's not possible, then try with a couple of months of retreat every year. 2 or 3 weeks should be the minimum, but any amount of retreat will, of course, be beneficial. Our time, our choice. If we don't set aside time for practice, then we must be honest with ourselves and admit that it's going to be very difficult to take advantage of the extraordinary opportunity we have right now in this life. At the moment, we are alive, but our life is running out whether we want it to or not. With every passing day, our life is one day shorter. No matter how we decide to spend our life, it will soon be all over. Maybe you're busy and have many commitments. Perhaps you feel you have lots of expectations to live up to. But is the rest of your life really fully booked already? Don't you get any say as to how you spend your time? Think about it. Is there really no free time during the day? Of course there is. In fact, we all have a great deal of influence on the way our life is structured. So why not exercise your influence now and set aside time for practice? If you schedule time in a place that is conducive for practice and has few distractions, you will be able to go far. Not a matter of watching. Once we are in a place where we can focus wholeheartedly on practice, the mind can settle and calm down. Then when the mind is at ease, it can develop insight into its own nature. As we allow our body, our voice, and our mind to rest in naturalness, we should remind ourselves, the view is not a matter of watching, so give up the act of looking. What happens when we take such an instruction to heart? As the mind rests in uncontrived naturalness, we remind ourselves that the right view cannot be produced or developed. Then what else can we do besides dropping all reference points, including the very idea of getting the view right? When all efforts and reference points are dropped completely, the basic nature of the mind is laid bare, and the realization of the right view dawns by itself. We know very well that unless we set aside time to practice, we'll never get around to it. Knowing something to be absolutely crucial and yet ignoring it isn't just pointless, it's absurd. It's like a person dying of thirst on the shore of a great lake. That's a good analogy to keep in mind. The grip of consciousness. Right view is the gateway to liberation. Our ignorant mind that spins in samsara is produced by our thoughts. Our thoughts are the basis for the negative emotions that drive our delusion and cause pain and misery for everyone. Thinking is our grasping mind. Thinking is our mind when it locks onto something and is unable to let go. This is the root of all of our problems, the grasping mind that cannot let go. This is a very important point. If our thoughts are causing the problem, if in fact they are the problem, then working with our thoughts is not a viable solution. It doesn't matter how skilled we may be at focusing and directing our attention, because it's exactly there, in the grip of consciousness, that the trouble starts. Thought-free wakefulness. Only a complete absence of thoughts can free us. We must achieve a state of wakefulness that is perfectly clear and thought-free. For that, no sort of meditation training is going to be useful because there is nothing to keep in mind, nothing to focus on, and nowhere to direct our attention. So give up the idea of meditation, and you will no longer be distracted. Thought-free wakefulness dissolves the grip of our ignorant, dualistic mind. Thought-free wakefulness blows up the grammar of ordinary consciousness and goes beyond subject, object, and action. Thought-free wakefulness cannot be grasped by thought. It is, quite literally, unthinkable. Still, we can train our consciousness to recognize it. Among the many techniques we can use, letting our mind rest in uncontrived naturalness is one of the best. Our true nature. I have mentioned this many times already. We must understand that all conditioned things are impermanent, and thereby see through all the deceptions that usually fool us. When we do that, it's hard not to feel revulsion towards the whole situation. With revulsion and disenchantment, the wish for freedom is kindled, a fervent longing for freedom that inspires and fuels all we do. Impermanence hurts. But the reason we contemplate death and destruction is not that we love to feel down. We do it because it gives us the courage and strength to look at the world with love and compassion. Love and compassion heal the mind. When we look at the world with loving eyes, all harmful thoughts and emotions vanish naturally. In this way, love and compassion enhance our understanding and training. The instructions tell us to release the hold of our dualistic mind. In the very moment conceptual mind releases its grip, we acknowledge the wakefulness that is the true nature of all beings. That's how we all truly are. We get this as a direct experience whenever the conceptual mind is suspended and our usual dualistic perception has collapsed. Our meditation is uncontrived naturalness. Remember the example of the murky water. If you leave the water alone, it clears on its own. The same goes for the mind. If we don't keep consciousness occupied, it settles, and the nature of mind reveals itself. Wide open like the sky. How do we become true practitioners of the Vajra vehicle? It all depends on the mind and consciousness. Our minds have to transform into the mind of a practitioner, wide open, and utterly beyond the tiny cage of thinking. Our minds must become boundless and unimpeded like the wide open sky. That's how to practice. Consciousness has released its grip, and there's no longer anything to hold on to, or anyone holding on. That's the perfect practice. All that remains is wisdom. Unadulterated, pure wakefulness. That is insight into the nature of reality, original, pure wakefulness. This insight differs from all other types of understanding and recognition because right there, in that very moment, reality is seen and recognized just as it is. It is the true nature of all beings. It is the awakening of all Buddhas. Beyond hope and fear. When the grip of the conceptual mind is undone, the original state appears and all the wonderful qualities that we have heard so much about are given the space to unfold. The Buddha's infinite love and compassion, the wisdom that sees everything while realizing the true nature of all, such qualities manifest from thought-free wakefulness. There's no longer anything to hope for. There's no longer anything to fear. We have broken free of all the different chains of the conceptual mind. The Tibetan master Gatsangpa once said, "The mind of an ordinary person is never anything but awakened wisdom." If you recognize that, even without having to be shown by a master, then there you go. The essence of the Buddha's teaching. We need to practice the heart of the teachings. That is what I try to do myself, and although I'm not always successful, I do my best. Here are three instructions that summarize the essence of the Buddhist teachings. Understanding that this world is impermanent and your time is short. Lessen attachment and learn to let go. Regard all beings as your own parents and train tirelessly in being generous, disciplined, patient, enthusiastic, concentrated, and wise. The nature of your mind is perfect awakening. Understand